This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. As a result of yesterday afternoon's games in Germany, the final contests in the round of group play, France and Switzerland advanced to the knockout round. The French posted their first victory by knocking off Togo 2-0. Switzerland got by South Korea by the identical score. Joining me now from Hamburg, where he has been covering the World Cup for Sports Illustrated, is Grant Wall. Grant, welcome back to the program.
Good to be back on, Bill.
Of the teams that finished first-round play yesterday, Spain is perhaps the most impressive. 3 games, 9 points. Is this a great team or just a team that found itself in a soft group?
Well, a little bit of both. Spain has a ton of talent on its team. If you look across the board from their forwards to their midfield back to their defense, they're really loaded. They're from the best league in the world. But you look at the draw that they got, it's nothing like what the U.S. got. You had Ukraine in that group. You had Saudi Arabia and Tunisia. So usually Spain at some point along the way finds a way to collapse, but it may be sooner rather than later. They have France in the second round.
Germany plays Sweden today in Munich. Historically, the home field advantage has, of course, been enormous in World Cup play, but does the German side even need it?
Well, it's a team that's playing much better than even their own fans thought they would coming into this game. Coach Jurgen Klinsmann got all sorts of static from the locals over the last couple of months. They were drilled by Italy 4-1 in one exhibition. And yet Germany throughout this tournament so far has played some really good soccer. They're fun to watch, even more so than probably previous Germany teams. And the crowd support has really come around. It's been interesting to see how it's gone from skepticism toward the start of this tournament to complete support these days.
After his team was bounced out of the tournament by Ghana on Thursday, U.S. coach Bruce Arena congratulated his opponents, and then he said his team might have made it to round two if they'd been in another group. What do you think?
Well, I guess that's possible. Every team, or every year in the group, the World Cup, you have a group of death, as these things are called, where you've got four teams that each one of them probably could have lasted into the round of 16 in another group. But at the same time, I think at the beginning of the tournament, Arena said no excuses when describing his U.S. team. And all we've really heard the last few days are excuses about the group that they drew or the calls that were made by the referees in this tournament against them. At some point, you have to say the U.S. just didn't play well enough to get through, and they didn't.
Ghana is perhaps the least celebrated team to make it to round two, the team for which underdog followers will root, I guess. Ghana will face defending champion Brazil on Tuesday. Any chance at all for an upset there?
I would have thought they might have had a chance if Michael Essien, their star midfielder, would be available for the game, but he picked up kind of a dubious yellow card in the game against the U.S. early on, and as a result, he's going to be suspended for the Brazil game, which is unfortunate because Ghana is one of these entertaining teams that would have been a lot of fun to see go back and forth with Brazil, and that may still happen, but a game that they might have had a shot in, I don't know if they do now with Essien out.
Fans looking for upsets might also consider today's game between Argentina, which scored 8 goals in the first round, and Mexico, which kind of limped into the second round with just 4 points. Or maybe I'm not giving Mexico the credit it deserves. Is limped the wrong word for how they got through?
Well, the Mexicans haven't played great soccer in this tournament to this point. They struggled to get a tie against Angola, did beat Iran after being tied for a long stretch of that game, and then lost to Portugal. One of their top forwards, Jorge Borghetti, is out with an injury, and it remains to be seen how much he'll be able to contribute in this tournament. Argentina has just been a steamroller so far, and it's really fun to watch this team play, by far the best team in the tournament so far. But the Mexicans are very familiar with Argentina. They play them a lot, played them in the U.S. last year, and it may be like the second-round game that the U.S. had against Mexico 4 years ago, where the familiarity there helped the U.S. think they could win the game. I think the Mexicans feel like they can beat Argentina, which is a team they competed well against with last year also at the Confederations Cup in Germany.
Among the things accomplished by Brazil in their 4-1 win over Japan on Thursday was the reclamation of Ronaldo, who scored twice and is now tied for most career goals in World Cup final competition. I guess he must have lost some weight overnight. Anyway, does Brazil have any weaknesses?
They do. I think even Ronaldo, even though he got those two goals, maybe one of them. You saw in the last game, he got two goals, but he's not played well when matched up with Adriano, his normal first-team partner up front. Played much better with Robinho, a faster player, is much more complimentary in their 4-1 win over Japan. Ronaldo still needs to be the old Ronaldo in some ways, which is to be very explosive and beating guys into the box, into the goal, because that's his problem these days. He's been called fatty. He's been called all these other things, but there's a reason for that. He's not moving the way he used to.
Portugal against the Netherlands is a second-round game that's particularly intriguing, at least to me. How do you see that one playing out?
Well, I saw those two teams play in the European Championship semifinals in Portugal 2 years ago. Portugal won that game. And this game is going to be a very, very good second-round game at the World Cup. When you see Portugal has Luis Figo, who has really had a resurgence the last few games for them. They won their group ahead of Mexico. The Netherlands have a player named Arjen Robben on the left wing, one of several left wingers we're seeing doing very well in this tournament, along with guys like Ronaldinho of Brazil and Joe Cole of England. Arjen Robben is a real spark plug for the Netherlands and has done a lot of good on the left side, moving the ball into the box. A very dangerous player, and I think we're going to see an end-to-end game that should be a lot of fun for the fans.
What's your choice for another don't miss this one in round two?
Well, I would say, looking down the list here, Argentina-Mexico could be a really good game. As I said before, the Mexicans are familiar with Argentina. I don't think they're going to be surprised by what Argentina throws at them. And even though the Mexicans haven't played to their best so far, they've had some success in Europe over the last couple years in a way that they hadn't. They're ready to take the next step, and they've drawn a tough match here, but I think they have a shot.
Grant Wall covers soccer for Sports Illustrated, and he spoke with me from Germany. Grant, thank you very much for joining me.
Good to be with you.
The 2006 NBA Draft takes place on Wednesday, when the much ballyhooed will be selected by the very needy. Just over 100 prospects have declared themselves eligible for this year's conscription, but since there are only 60 picks in the draft's two rounds, the supply of players easily outweighs the demand. But as Only a Game's Gabe O'Connor reports, basketball's long and winding roads could lead the undrafted to the NBA eventually.
Good shot, kid.
When Donald Jeffers declared himself eligible for the 2006 NBA draft, most experts thought it was a bad idea. That is, those who noticed.
Oh! Good shot, kid.
At 6'9" and a wiry 210 pounds, the 21-year-old left-handed guard stood out in a game of one-on-one at the Reggie Lewis Center in Roxbury, Massachusetts. But sticking out amongst hundreds of NBA draft hopefuls is something entirely different, especially when your career consists of one season at a Missouri junior college and another at Roxbury Community College. Still, Jeffers doesn't think he's a long shot.
As of right now, nah. Because I feel that as long as I keep myself focused and put myself around all those good people, anything can happen. It's not a long shot. Of course not.
Those good people are actually a network of friends and family that includes cousin Marcus Banks, a point guard for the Minnesota Timberwolves. But that group doesn't include ESPN draft analyst Chad Ford.
Donald who?
Jeffers.
I don't know him.
Wow.
Uh-oh.
Being unknown can sometimes be better than being in the snarky crosshairs of some of the so-called draft experts who litter the internet and airwaves. One scouting report on Jeffers simply read, "Shouldn't there be an R in his last name?" Ford says it can be difficult to be fair to unheralded prospects.
As a journalist covering the draft, you have the same problem that everybody does. And as a journalist that covers not only the college guys, but the international players as well, you've got hundreds of prospects. You don't have an unlimited budget to go to every school and see every team. You don't have unlimited time to do that. And so you have to start to make evaluations. And what many do and what I do is consult with NBA scouts who are on the road and who will raise names from time to time. Occasionally you see an obscure prospect. It is very difficult. The odds are stacked against them. And really all they can do is throw their name into the draft.
One NBA hopeful who did that was junior forward Evan Patterson, one of the best players on a Texas Wesleyan team that won this year's NAIA championship. He decided to test the 2006 draft waters, but wanted to maintain his eligibility. NCAA rules state that the moment a player hires an agent, he's no longer eligible to play college ball. Patterson quickly realized that without an agent, he was in a tough situation.
A lot of times agents may be cool with this general manager or this coach, and they can get you in the door. But me talking to somebody directly, they're going to say, well, who are you? You know, it's kind of who you know.
Faced with the daunting task of self-promotion, Evan Patterson decided to go back to Texas Wesleyan for his senior season. But the good news for both Patterson and Donald Jeffis is that there are more avenues to the NBA than ever before. Undrafted free agents find their way onto NBA rosters every year. The MBDL, the CBA, the USBL, and the ABA are there for those that don't. Many American ballplayers have had long, successful careers in the European leagues, which they've used as stepping stones to the NBA. Patterson knows this, and he thinks scouts will eventually notice him.
You got to understand, you know, if you can play, they'll find you. And look at Scottie Pippen. He came from NAIA school. Devin George plays for the Lakers. He played Division III basketball, and as low as you can get. So I don't think that you can look at the glass half empty. You know, I think you got to look at it half full. If the opportunity arises, you know, and I do it the right way, I think I'll be successful.
Donald Jeffis continues to work out 7 hours a day. He won't likely hear his name called in next week's draft, but like Patterson, he also knows he's not out of options.
I take anything. Anything to get to the NBA, whatever it takes, because look at Steven Jackson. It took him over 6 years, 5 years to get me. He went CBA, USBL, everything, EBA. So it's just like, you got to do whatever it takes to get it if you want it that bad.
15 years ago, most fans and even NBA scouts would have listened to Donald Jeffis and laughed. Now they know. You never know. For Only a Game, I'm Gabe O'Connor in Boston.
Right back at you. Oh!
Gone, gone, gone with the draft. Gone, gone, gone with the draft. Gone, gone, gone with the draft. When Skinny Me went out with my honey, the boys all started to laugh. But now it's not so funny. They're all gone with the draft.
It's 19. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game during the summer solstice. If you're ever in Alaska, stop and see some baseball, open all night. But first, I'm joined by ESPN's Tim Kirkchin for some baseball talk. Hi, Tim.
How are you, Bill?
Very well, thank you. Let's start with a team that's doing very well. Is it time for the other four clubs in the National League East to concede the division title to the New York Mets?
Yes, Bill, it is over in that division. And it's not necessarily because the Mets are great, because I don't think they're great. I think they're really good, especially offensively. I just don't think there's another good team in the division. And that includes the Braves, who, by the way, I picked to win the division this year. How am I looking on that one?
0-1 so far, but we'll give you some more chances.
The Braves have just fallen apart. I just can't imagine how this has happened this quickly to them, and I just don't think they're coming back to win the division this year. And the Phillies have been up and down, and the rest of the division just isn't there. So the Mets are good, but the rest of the division so far is bad, and that's why this thing is over in the middle of June.
Elsewhere in the National League, nobody in the West is doing especially well, but nobody in the West is doing especially badly either, at least relatively. Who eventually wins that division?
Well, I've changed my mind about five times on that division already, Bill, which is not a good thing to do. But I think the Dodgers are going to win. And I picked the Giants at the beginning of the year with the warning that they can't win unless Barry Bonds is healthy and plays most of the season, which, of course, has not happened so far. I just think the Dodgers, with all these young guys that they brought in, have been so impressive with these young arms and some of these young outfielders, Matt Kemp and third baseman Willie Ibar, people like that have been really, really good. And, you know, I think it's only going to take 85 wins again to win this division, but I'll take the Dodgers for today, and I promise you if you ask me next week, I'll give you another team.
Well, Tim, as we speak, the Detroit Tigers cling to first place in the American League Central Division. Tell me you picked them to win.
No, I picked them. I picked them to finish fourth.
Oh.
So how am I looking on that one? I actually liked what I saw from the Tigers this spring. I liked it a lot, and I loved the influence that Jim Leland brought. I just didn't think they were ready. It's really, really hard to make a jump that they're attempting to make this year, and they are well on their way to making that huge jump. And I really think beyond the great young talent that they have, the Justin Verlanders and the Joel Zamayas, these young guys who throw 100 miles an hour, I think Jim Leland walked in and said, fellas, we're not going to lose anymore around here, okay? I'm not putting up with it. And as you know, after about a month of the season, he started screaming at his team saying, look, this is how we used to play here, okay? We're giving up. We're not doing that while I'm here. And they all listened. And since then, they've played well over 650 baseball. It has been an amazing story in Detroit. And, Bill, you don't fake it for 70 games. You don't fool people for that long. This team is for real, and they are not only in the division race, but they're certainly in the wild card race in the American League also.
The defending world champion Chicago White Sox aren't exactly having a bad season at this point, but you wouldn't know that from some of the things Chicago manager Ozzie Guillen has been saying. Is this post-winning-it-all stress syndrome?
No, this is just Ozzie being Ozzie. He did similar things last year, Bill. He lit into his team, by the way, with about a week to go in the season, and everyone said, oh, that's it, they're crumbling, they're choking, Ozzie is a bad influence. And instead of being a bad influence, the team took off from there. This is one thing about Ozzie. He's going to speak his mind. He's going to say some outrageous things. He's going to anger a lot of people, and he's going to make a lot of people laugh. But the one thing he does is he never gets in the way of his team. He is not a distraction to that team. In fact, I think he takes some of the pressure off of them, and I know they all understand whatever Ozzie says, it's just Ozzie being Ozzie. Now, some of the things he said, he's going to have to tone down at some point. But is this affecting, you know, the White Sox on the field? Absolutely not. In the middle of one of his tirades, they scored 69 runs in six games, and they won them all. I don't think he's a distraction.
Looming over the season is the possibility that relief pitcher Jason Grimsley and former starting pitcher Paxton Crawford, who have both acknowledged using human growth hormone, will begin naming names. Those names will be public. How are players everywhere feeling about that possibility?
Well, they're certainly a little bit nervous that in an affidavit, one player, Grimsley, has named names. And it's only a matter of time before those names come out officially. And we've heard a zillion rumors, and I can't go there until I get a little bit closer to the truth on this. But it's making some players nervous, and I think more players are going to come out. I don't think it's going to be one a week. I don't think it's even going to be five a year. But I think enough players are going to get tired of this. Enough players are going to be unfairly accused of something, as David Segui was. And he came out and said, look, I'm doing human growth hormone because I got a prescription from the doctor. It helps me heal my wrists. I don't even play anymore. I'm just taking it to try to age a little more gracefully than I am right now. And I think that's what some players will come out and say, look, all right, I did it. I'm guilty. But here's why I did it. I didn't do it to get bigger and stronger and hit a bunch more homers. I did it to try to recover faster so I could help my team. It's still wrong, it's still illegal, but I just don't think it's in every case, yeah, I did this so I could get bigger and stronger and hit a lot more homers and make a lot more money. I'm not sure that's always the case.
It was interesting that in the ESPN The Magazine story, Paxton Crawford said that pitchers took this stuff not to get bigger and stronger, but to be able to work out more and to have their careers last longer. This is going to be a new one for a lot of fans.
Well, it is, and that's what most pitchers have told me along the way, and I haven't talked to too many of them about it, but what they're most concerned about is how do I feel the day after throwing 115 pitches in a game? That's usually a really sore day, and yet some of them who were doing the stuff, at least according to other people, said, hey, I feel great the next day, and when my start came up 4 days later, I felt ready to go. And relief pitchers are saying, normally, I can't go 3 days in a row. But by doing this stuff once in a while, I feel much better that third day. And that's what it's all about. Recovery is the HGH, the real best part of that is it allows you to come back and be fresher and stronger a day or so later.
ESPN's Tim Kirkjian joins me on some of Only a Game's best days to talk about baseball. Tim, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure, Bill.
This past Wednesday was the longest day of the year and marked the official start of summer. In Fairbanks, Alaska, at the solstice, nights remain bright and cheerful. For the last 100 years, the locals there have celebrated the unending sun with a timeless game. Libby Casey of member station KUAC attended the centennial edition of the Midnight Sun Baseball Classic, and she has this report.
It's the bottom of the sixth inning and nearly midnight. The first pink streaks of sunset are just showing, and the players adjust their caps to shield their eyes. No one in the crowd yawns, and no matter what, the artificial lights won't go on. They won't need to. This is Midnight Sun Baseball.
It's still blue in the sky and it's still light out. That's what I love. And then you can stay up all night. Summer light, you're always happy.
14-year-old Alex Hajdukovic is at his first Midnight Sun game. He's continuing a tradition that's nearly as old as Fairbanks itself. A century ago, the promise of gold lured prospectors north to the new town. They may have left the comforts of home behind, but they brought along their favorite pastime. Alaska Baseball League founder Red Boucher.
It's a story that goes around how all this started. Supposedly, some old-timers, miners, were having a debate as to how bright it was in Fairbanks at midnight. And one guy says, hey, it's so bright you can play a baseball game out there. And that was the beginning of the Midnight Sun game.
85-year-old Bill Stroker has been to scores of solstice games, but his dad played in the very first one.
Way back in 1906, things were a little bit crude back then. I don't think the fielders even used mitts. So that's the way it was in the real early game. So, oh yeah, everything has changed, you know. I mean, they didn't have the funds and the means to have this type of a bleacher or lawn or anything like that. But they had the spirit. It was there.
Stroker inherited his father's love of baseball and for over 40 years has served as president of the club that carries on the Midnight Sun tradition. The Gold Panners started in 1960, and now the team draws collegiate players from around the country who are hungry to go pro. Alumni include Hall of Famers Tom Seaver and Dave Winfield. Gold Panners fan Kevin Ginley has boarded players at his house for the last 15 summers. He says they leave Alaska with a sense of the tradition.
They're going to be grandparents, and they're going to tell their grandkids and their great-grandkids that they played a game, in the game of baseball, up in Alaska when the sun was shining in the middle of the night, and them kids are going to be sitting there going, oh, yeah, yeah, sure, Grandpa. And they're going to say, yeah, I did. You know, it's just stories to be able to tell their grandkids, you know.
Gold Panners right fielder Jordan Mayer agrees. He's up from Louisiana State University.
This is my first Midnight Sun game. It's a thing I'll never forget. I tell you what, I had a great time in that game. That's probably the most fun I've had in a long time. It's just no pressure, you know, summer baseball, out having fun, you know, just relaxing, playing the game that we love. And that's what it's all about.
Mayer's teammate, Joey Dunn, says the never-ending light can take some getting used to.
It's kind of freaking me out, to be honest. Still got shadows floating around. It's midnight. So it's exciting, something new.
Spectator Rob Lindsay is used to the daylight since he grew up in Fairbanks and spent summers fielding fly balls at Gold Panners games. Now he lives down south in Minnesota. But on this visit, he's sharing the Midnight Sun tradition with his own family.
It's the only game I know of where you can start a game at 10:30 at night and play without artificial lights. And there's a buzz in town and everybody gets excited. And I think parents are a little bit less likely to push their kids to go to bed on a night like this. And it's a special thing.
The game's not just about the sunlight. Close to midnight, play stops for Alaska's state song. It's a tune any homegrown Alaskan knows, and even the teenagers pause on their cell phones for a moment. Singer Sally Ann Thibodeau started coming to Midnight Sun games as a kid. She says there's something magical about them, like you're stepping back in time.
It preserves some of the innocence of the old-fashioned baseball games, and the reason we used to come out to the games in the first place is to just be with our friends and watch a good game. And it lends itself to our independence because we're outside and it's kind of one with nature, even though it's an all-American pastime.
From a seat in the Gold Panners bleachers, the requirements for happiness are pretty basic. Peanuts, $2 beer, a visor, and that's about it. There are very few reminders of the world beyond the outfield. No blare of commercials or scrolling electronic ads. For a few hours, it's just sharing a good game of baseball.
Take me out to the ball game. Take
This year's Gold Panners game wrapped up at 12:30 a.m., early by midnight sun standards, and it was a perfect finish, a 2-1 win over the Beatrice Bruins of Nebraska in the 10th inning, capping off the home team's 14th midnight sun victory in a row.
There it is! There it is!
When the game ends, the crowd slowly filters out. There's no rush home. There'll be plenty of time to sleep when winter comes. After tonight, the days can only get shorter. But there are weeks of Gold Panners baseball left in summer, and with all the hours in a day, plenty of time to kick back and play ball. For Only a Game, I'm Libby Casey in Fairbanks, Alaska.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org.
But oh, my darling, always I'll remember when your lips were close to mine and I saw the midnight sun.
You're listening to Only a Game. It is possible to take the World Cup too seriously. Consider, for example, that when the Costa Rican team returned winless and drawless and pointless from Germany, they were greeted at the airport by fans shouting "dog" at the coach and carrying signs urging the players to take jobs picking coffee beans. But the marvelous thing about this particular sports event is that it is also possible to continue finding joy in it after the team from your country has disappointed you. In the World Cup, the most dependable source of joy is the Brazilian team, which plays with an exceptional combination of expertise and delight. Who can watch Brazil without smiling? Wouldn't it be wonderful to be able to do anything as well as the Brazilians play soccer? But in the World Cup, the potential giggle is everywhere. Ghana, through to the second round in their first appearance in the tournament, has been characterized as the Brazil of Africa. They have brought surprise as well as energy and discipline to the event. It's sort of a shame that the Brazil of Africa have to meet the Brazil of South America on Tuesday. If you haven't picked a team for which to cheer now that the U.S. has come home, and you can't get over being sore at Ghana for stifling Landon Donovan at all, you might consider England, rendered a kind of underdog when they lost striker Michael Owen to a knee injury. How can you not root for a side that may end up playing as Owen's replacement, a 17-year-old so inexperienced that he has yet to even appear for his club team? Like all long tournaments, one of the benefits of the World Cup is that it provides the time for various subplots to develop as the weeks roll on. Will Mexico, which backed into the second round with a loss to Portugal, find itself and give Argentina a game? Will Spain, long a disappointment to some of the most passionate fans in the world, break its long tradition of discouraging those fans in the round of 16 or the quarterfinals? But unlike the tournaments that determine the baseball, basketball, football, and hockey champions in the U.S., the World Cup starts with a qualification process that involves contenders and pretenders from over 200 countries. The results of sometimes provoked insults, squawks about the officiating, brawls, and once in Colombia after the 94 World Cup, the murder of a player. But most soccer fans regard the event as a festival. And for anyone inclined to seek an image of not only common interest, but a shared passion for beauty that, for a fragile few weeks, transcends differences in race, religion, and language, the World Cup stands alone.
Ay, yeah.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at cabotcheese.com, and Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting, available at the Implant Dentistry Center at bicon.com, bicon.com. This is NPR, National.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, golfing till your hands bleed, and other tales of ordinary madness. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Regarding basketball, the Miami Heat won their first NBA title on Tuesday. Is there any need for more than two words, Dwayne Wade?
Well, you could go four words and say Marquette University, too, but feel free. As is the case with this show, being led by a guy from Marquette can only lead to good things. Yeah, that's a performance that people are going to talk about for 20 years. He personally picked up the team and carried it. There was the wonderful deference by the big Aristotle, who chose to be the big supporting player.
Mm-hmm.
The surprise of the finals to me was that Miami's bench outplayed Dallas's, which was not supposed to be the case. But Udonis Haslam and the petrified Forrest at the end of the Miami bench, now owning championship rings, Alonzo Mourning, Antoine Walker, Gary Payton,
hey.
Shandon Anderson, and I'm sure Joe Fulks is down there somewhere too.
Do you blame the failure of the Mavericks to take advantage of the lead they had in the final series on A, Dallas owner Mark Cuban, B, Dirk Nowitzki's inexplicable inability to sink two foul shots when he really needed to do that, or C, Mark Cuban?
Well, it's been pointed out extensively that we won't be hearing any Larry Bird comparisons on Dirk Nowitzki for a while. The man was invisible when his team really needed it. Mark Cuban has gone past blowhard and is now a blight. Don't wear the fanboy jersey. Don't accuse the product of being rigged, and just shut up.
Elsewhere in the NBA, the fraying rope from which Larry Brown has been dangling for some time finally broke, and so he's no longer coach of the New York Knicks. Were you astonished to learn who'll be replacing him?
Yes, Captain Hazelwood. Here's another oil tanker to take out to sea. Isaiah Thomas, who, by the way, has failed at everything he's done since he left the game as a player, will replace Larry Brown. This is no surprise. The Knicks are an embarrassment. They will continue to be an embarrassment. Isaiah Thomas took a team that Larry Bird had great success with in Indiana and ran it into the ground. He's now taking a really bad team, which he can run even further into the ground.
Charlie, the National Hockey League also has a new champion. The Carolina Hurricanes are the first team in North Carolina to win a major pro title, except, of course, for the UNC women's soccer team. Does this change everything in Raleigh?
Well, y'all are forgetting the various race teams that win national titles. Dale Earnhardt's race team won a couple of national titles. See, you're on that women's soccer thing. You're not on the race teams. But very good for Carolina. Very good for people like Ron Brindamore and Glenn Wesley, who are sort of the Antoine Walker and Gary Payton of their sport. They hung on, though. I'll tell you, I thought when Edmonton lost Dwayne Rolison, its lead goalie, in game one, I thought they were done. They put up a heck of a fight. They came back. They couldn't overcome the effort of coming back from 3-1 and having to win it on the road. The Stanley Cup now moves from Tampa to Carolina. It's gradually getting closer to Toronto.
Heading north to ice and snow.
Maple Leaf fans, fear not. It's moving closer every year to Toronto.
The U.S. men's soccer team demonstrated that to succeed in that particular game, it is advisable to score more than two-thirds of a goal per game. What do we do now? Fire the coach, fire the players, outlaw the sport?
Flotsam. Detritus on the sea of international soccer. Stumble bums. The New York Knickerbockers of the world. I, as a patriotic American citizen, was shocked and insulted by the performance of these cows. I look at this, and you obviously know more about this than I do, but I look at a sport where the talent went the other way, which is basically the European players who came over here to play basketball and either went to the highest level colleges or came right over and played in the NBA young, played against the best competition in the world. I don't think we have enough players here playing overseas in the best competition in the world. I think you've got to look seriously as to whether MLS is good or bad for international soccer.
In the obligatory sports government news, the Bush administration Wednesday urged a federal judge to force the two reporters who wrote a book about Barry Bonds to reveal their source for leaked grand jury testimony in the Balco investigation. So it's free speech versus government's right to know who wins this version of the battle.
Well, this is a shot across the bow of people covering other things, such as the conduct of the war, the run-up of the war. He doesn't want leaks. He doesn't want them anywhere. This is a high-profile case. This is another in a continuing series of an administration which has been overly secretive and, frankly, contemptuous of the First Amendment since the time it got into office. I hope they lose. I have a feeling they may not.
Speaking of baseball and illegal substances, the immortal Paxton Crawford, late of the Boston Red Sox, became the latest ex-pitcher to say that he and other pitchers used human growth hormone, among other substances, during their careers. So, I guess that means that whatever Barry Bonds ends up accomplishing shouldn't get asterisked because the pitchers were juiced, too.
Well,
level playing field, right?
In a certain mad way, yes. This is this is going to be now the sport of the summer, which is to find some guy who will admit to almost anything on the record. If you listen to Paxton Crawford's thing, there are no names in here. Teammates tell him something. Other teammates he see, it's general, no names. I am Paxton Crawford, and I'm back on the sports page. Now, I'm not saying it isn't a problem. I'm not saying he isn't telling the truth. What I'm saying is you're going to see a bunch of these sort of horror tenpenny novel stories as the summer goes along.
Just last fall, Ozzie Guillen, the manager of the Chicago White Sox, was a genius. His team won the World Series. This week, he's under fire for insults he leveled at a Chicago columnist. Does he get to be a genius again if the White Sox repeat as World Series champions?
He's an insensitive, homophobic genius. I have a feeling the world is probably full of those. Yeah, he's going to have to go sensitivity training, where he's going to have to learn that questioning someone's sexuality and doing so in a derogatory manner should not be the first club out of the bag when you're mad at a reporter. I've always said this. The English language is a wonderful tool. It has many things you can call reporters, all of them much more entertaining than one Guillen reached for. With all of this vast, proud vista of invective, something like what Guillen says is the first club out of the bag. Number one, you have a real problem with gay people, and number two, you have a real problem with the English language.
And finally, Charlie, fans of England's soccer team are delighted that their side has gone through to round two of the World Cup, and my understanding is that the team has collected some unusual fans in Merseyside.
Yes, there's a baboon enclosure in the safari park in Merseyside. Who knew there was a safari park in Merseyside?
Who indeed?
We learn everything. Apparently, the baboons have taken to taking the English flags off the cars. You know, people put the English flags on the cars to celebrate England's continuing unforgivable participation in the World Cup, and planting them in the little enclosure. If you drove into the Knowsley Safari Park in Merseyside with a United States soccer flag on your car, the monkeys would not steal it.
Charlie Pierce, monkeys
have pride.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me at this time each week on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Ole, 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 ole. Goodbye, goodbye.
Some men beginning to sense that they will not be young and strong forever buy red sports cars. Others get hair weaves. Tom Coyne decided to dedicate more than a year of his life to making himself the best golfer he could be, just in case he could be really good. His adventure, funded by a book contract, involved hiring a swing coach and a sports psychologist, not to mention more than 540 days of golf. Tom Coyne has chronicled his progress in Paper Tiger, subtitled An Obsessed Golfer's Quest to Play with the Pros. He joins me now from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. Tom Coyne, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
When you decided to spend a year seeking the perfect golf swing, how good a golfer were you?
Basically where the book sort of starts out, I mean, technically, I guess I'm about a 14 handicap. I played a lot when I was a junior player. When I was, 10, 12, 13, 14, I could sometimes break 80. And where the story starts, I hadn't played seriously for a number of years. And so I was basically, an 88 shooter. I'd go out and sign for my 87 and it made me a 14 handicap. And that was fine. I just had fun with golf. I was on the Monday scramble circuit. It was sort of where my game was.
A couple of months into your excellent golf adventure, you get a visit in Florida from your then-girlfriend. And at one point, she says, quote, "I think you need to take more breaks." What inspired that observation?
I think that was the day that my hands spontaneously sort of just burst open and my hands just started to bleed. It wasn't blisters. They just sort of cracked. And it was interesting. I'm sitting there on the range and it didn't hurt. It was kind of cool. And I said, wow, I the expression when I hit balls until my hands bleed. And I was like, my hands are bleeding. Wow, I really did that. And and I didn't, So she said, well, I think you need to take a break. And there were not that many breaks in this story because I figured if I'm going to do this, I have to go all day, every day, all the time, or the story's not going to really work. I pull no punches, no excuses, sun up, to sundown.
At the point where your handicap index has dropped to 5.2 and your weight has dropped to 211 pounds, you write, and I'm quoting again, "Golf is not so much difficult as it is absurd." Having realized that, how could you go on?
I got to write a book about it. I couldn't exactly stop right there.
He had a contract.
Be a good story, you know. I had a book contract. It's an interesting sort of phenomenon, and I wasn't the only person sort of thinking that. I was starting to get to know a lot of these mini tours, sort of on the cusp of greatness, you know, grinding players that are they're all over Florida, all over Arizona, California, any of the warm weather states, you know. And I talk about in the book as almost a golf depression. And when you give everything and every minute, every penny, everything that you have, you know, to this game, putting a ball in a hole that's 500 yards away with using a tool that's totally ill-suited for the purpose, it is absurd. And when you give everything to doing that and you can't hit it straight, I mean, it literally just breaks your heart. And I had a lot of those broken hearts all over the world through that story. I mean, there were a lot of great, really wonderful successes and triumphs, but it is a game that tells you, man, this is crazy. But at the same time, you know, you hit one good once in a while, and that's just enough to make you a little crazier.
Allison, the same then girlfriend who told you that you needed to take more breaks when your fingers exploded, figures prominently in one of your best tournament moments, which occurs in Pennsylvania, tournament in Pennsylvania. Tell us of the elusive drive on that second hole of that tournament.
Yeah, that was a good hole. I was playing the U.S. Open qualifying that I was playing in Harrisburg. And Allison had come to caddy, as she did throughout the story. It was basically, if she wanted to see me or spend 5 hours with me, the best chance to do it was really by caddying for me in a tournament. So she did caddy for me throughout most of the story. We're at the U.S. Open qualifying. You know, this is kind of my first big tournament back from Florida. I've gotten my handicap down to, you know, one, and I've made some really great scores. But I come up here, and I par the first hole. We get to the second hole, and I just missed my target by a little bit. I'm probably 5 yards off the fairway. But, you know, the rough's grown up. It's sort of like green spaghetti, and I get out there, and we can't find the ball. And I just about, you know, this is before I start working with my psychologist, so I completely sort of lose it. And that's three strokes. You got to walk back to the tee. I'm playing with two professionals. There's three professionals behind me, and here I am after two holes. The whole golf course has come to a halt because we can't find my ball. So I reach into the bag, and I start making that loneliest walk in sports, you know, back to the tee where the guys are looking at me behind us, what are you doing? And she calls out, I found it. And it was just such the look on her face was priceless. It's not only that she found it and saved me three strokes in the U.S. Open qualifying, but she was participating. You know, she was part of this tournament. You know, as a caddy, she'd stepped up and found the ball. And I went from the worst boyfriend ever, which I was up until that moment, the stuff that was coming out of my mouth, to she saved the day. And we went on and made a par. And wow, that wasn't that great.
Your original goal was to play in the qualifying school tournament, the same event in which the guys aspiring to play on the PGA Tour must excel. That didn't work out, but you did get to play against golfers seeking to make careers in the game. Nevertheless, you had to go to Australia to do so. How did that go?
I did, yeah. Well, I ended up playing in three qualifying schools, the Canadian Tour, the Tour de las Americas, the Latin American Tour, and then ultimately, where the story ends, is down in Melbourne, Australia, at the qualifying school for the Australasian Tour. And for someone who was afraid to fly, it was a pretty serious journey to see where my golf had taken me. So we went down to Melbourne, and that's my last tournament in this story. And Allison came the whole way to caddy for me.
Well, speaking of the long-suffering, sometimes golf bag-carrying Allison, she gets a shining surprise at the end of one particular round of golf. Tell us about that.
It was funny how it worked out because we go to Australia, and basically we'd been dating for, you know, 8 years before I decided to do this. And most guys after 8 years, you know, they go out and get a ring. In my case, I said I'm going to go play golf for a year and a half and see how that works out. She supported the whole thing and sort of was just excited about this chance that I was going to really get to chase this dream and never have to wonder again, you know, was I or was I not good enough? And so I said, you know, when this is over, you know, then we'll take the next step. So when it was literally over, was the final hole, at the Ranfurly Golf Course, which is where we played the Australasian Q School. And she was caddying for me, and she didn't know it, but the whole week she'd been carrying my bag. She'd also been carrying around a big diamond in the side pocket. We get to the last hole, and I've got like a six-foot slider for par. It's like, don't miss this. Don't make bogey and then go ask someone to marry you. Come on, put this in the hole. And it did. I made par on the final hole, and there was a little gallery. I'd asked her to go find grab my keys out of my bag, and I watched her sort of from a few feet away. She reached in, and instead of my keys weren't there, but this black furry box was, which I think has to be a pretty distinctive feeling item for any young lady, and she just about fell over right there. So here I am out in the middle of the Australian countryside, down on my knee on the 18th green of this tournament, proposing to my caddy. It was great. It was just a great moment. Everyone was totally confused. She was crying. As soon as the ball was in the hole, I said, "That's it. I'm done. We've played all my tournaments. I've given everything that we have to golf and learned so much about myself along the way and what it is like to be obsessed with something like this." I was very happy to move on, you know, to that next stage for both of us.
So it sounds as if you are cured now of the delusion that if everything had broken right for you, you could have been out there on the PGA Tour.
I don't know. I'm just waiting for the next book deal. If I can do it for 5 years on the Senior Tour, I can make it happen. No. I mean, cured certainly, but you always have those. You always wonder, you know, what if I did that one more thing, or what if I didn't hit that ball out of bounds, and who knows, you know? I mean, there were so many moments along the way where for 16 holes, I could look just like them. I could hit it far enough. I could hit it straight. I was a decent enough putter, but it was those other two holes where I was busy making a nine, you know, where I was
That'll
in the bunker
you.
Having a fight with my golf ball and losing. Those few holes where I could really expose myself as the imposter that I was.
Tom Coyne is the author of Paper Tiger, An Obsessed Golfer's Quest to Play with the Pros, published by Gotham Books. He joined me from WHYY in Philadelphia. Tom, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you.
Your roar is much worse than your
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Simon Wood and from Kevin Griffin at WHYY in Philadelphia. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to view photos of this year's Midnight Sun Baseball Classic, learn more about Paper Tiger, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Charlie Pierce, who offers his quadrennial World Cup declaration.
The World Cup is foreign.
Sí, pero ¿qué es tu problema, hombre? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston and from the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities on the web at WKKF.org. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness on the web at MelvilleTrust.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with a new website at MacFound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.